Teaching meditation can be a deeply rewarding experience. Help others improve their mental and emotional well-being, reduce stress, improve focus, increase self-awareness and self-regulation, all while deepening your own practice and understanding. Join acclaimed author, Buddhist teacher, and Emmy Award-winning musician David Nichtern on Tuesday, May 28th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time for a free online discussion on teaching meditation in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern on May 28th.
I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Server Member Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Server Member Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
It's almost a mantra in my life now. It's something that you taught me, which is the healing is in the return.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many times a week I remind myself of that. And I think that is such a beautiful summation of it all. And not just subjectively, you know, you remind yourself like the when I was emotionally unloading on Raghu about what I consider to be a kind of, you know, falling off the path. You know, he was giving me that reminder. You know, you can always go back. Like, that's the beauty of it. But I think, not to get too extraordinary here, but I think globally that is an incredible thing for the planet to remind itself of.
Hello and welcome to the Metta Hour podcast with Sharon Salzberg. I'm Lily Cushman and I produce this podcast. And today we're bringing you episode 239. Sharon sitting down with her friends Duncan Trussell and Raghu Marcus. Duncan and Raghu have recently released a new audiobook, Moving from the Movie of Me to the Movie of We. And today's conversation is all about the new project. If you don't know Duncan, he is a stand-up comedian, a podcaster, a writer, an actor. He's most known for his podcast, The Duncan Trussell Family Hour, of which Sharon has been a guest many times. He's an incredible interviewer, and those of you who have heard Sharon speak many times, it's a real treat to hear her on his podcast because he somehow ekes out different details in the stories that she tells, and it's a whole bunch of fun. Duncan has also produced and starred in the Netflix series The Midnight Gospel, and he does tour regularly doing his stand-up comedy. Raghu is someone that you probably definitely know. He is the executive director of the Love, Serve, Remember Foundation. He hosts the Mind Rolling podcast here on the Be Here Now Network. And he's one of the original Met the Man folks in the Maharaji circle. He spent 2 years in India with Neem Karoli Baba and Ram Dass. And he is also deeply involved in music and transformational media since the early 1970s. So this is a super fun episode, all kinds of different topics, a lot of old stories about Duncan's childhood, Raghu's childhood, and how those early years conditioned them to be who they are now and find the teachings of Ram Dass and contemplative practice. Duncan talks about meeting Ram Dass for the first time, taking psychedelics at an early age, and how Raghu went to India, how eventually his parents both came. So there's a lot of looking back at our history and how that informs our path, and some interesting conversation about the difference between self-preoccupation and self-love, what it means to be of service and cultivate these qualities of unconditional love, both for ourselves and for others. And there are some great Ram Dass stories. As always, Duncan is kind of playing the role of the skeptic here, asking the questions that many of us have but maybe are too shy to ask. And lastly, there's some good discussion about this great Ram Dass quote to remember your Buddha nature and your social security number. To close out this conversation, we have a special appearance from Ram Dass from the archives, from the ether, leading a guided loving awareness meditation. So let's get to today's episode. Duncan Trussell and Raghu Marcus.
Hello, Duncan and Raghu, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi.
Hi. Always love being here. Wherever we are.
Where are you? Where are you in physical space right now?
Yeah, so we're in Ojai, California, and Duncan?
Austin, Texas.
Yeah.
Well, it's delightful to have you. And Raghu, I wouldn't have a podcast if it weren't for you. In fact, when you first suggested it, I think I said, "What's a podcast?" So thank you.
Okay, well, now we're going to have to turn it around because I've said this a billion times and he loves it. But the podcast guru of mine, Duncan Trussell, that is how I got into this. And it's so long ago, Duncan.
So long ago. Incredible.
I mean, years and years and years go by, but it's been a delight. And, you know, don't you have fun, Sharon, like talking to people you don't know and you get to meet them on the podcast and hear about their lives and what their interest is? And
I do have fun, and they're excited to be on the podcast, you know, which is great.
Yeah.
I bet.
Yeah.
So and we're here now celebrating the release of your new joint book project.
Oh, yes, the movie of me to the movie of we.
That's right, yeah. Which is now available in audiobook and ebook formats. What a huge project. That was many years in the making, I'm sure. And tell me about it.
You know, Duncan, I just got to say, Duncan and I did a podcast for his Family Hour podcast just a couple of days ago. And Duncan started by just talking about some stuff that was going on in his life, both worldly and spiritual, which we ended up talking about what that really is. But all's to say is that we have been doing this, the two of us. I don't know if it's a bunch of complaining about our lives or pointing to, you know, the way that we sort of miserably react to stuff still at this stage. For me, I was talking to Duncan, as I said, a couple of days ago. So it always seems to revolve back to the movie of me.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's all self-referential. And
right.
And this, the work you've been doing, Sharon, for all these years to help, you know, along mindfulness and meditation, you know, which is the way to enable people to be able to get a handle on being able to live a little bit more balanced and maybe happier. So yeah, that thing has been going on since Duncan and I met, which is probably 12, 13 years ago or something.
At least.
Yeah. But you and I, of course, Sharon, I've known, well, I'm not going to say all the years for that one.
A lot of years.
A lot of years. And we've been doing that as well. And Sharon's been a wonderful teacher.
I feel like the book is, you know, Raghu, you and Sharon both have had this remarkable experience of meeting awakened beings. And that is such great karma and so impossible for, I think, a lot of people to understand. And the more you study this stuff, the more you realize how profound it is that both of you got to encounter the people that you encountered. And I feel like the book is really, it's a kind of timeless conversation that I think has happened for as long as there have been awakened beings and people who've met them. Those people leave the awakened beings inevitably and then tell the stories and talk about it and hopefully are open to ridiculous questions and all of the crazy questions people who have never met a person like that have. And I feel like that's what the that's our book is. You're just listening to, I think, a conversation that has been going on forever and has definitely impacted my life in a profound way. I'll never know if it has impacted it as much as had I sat at the feet of the guru in India, but certainly it is, I look at it as something that changed the trajectory of my life for the better. And I feel like that is what it's a dialogue between someone who had such great karma and somebody who doesn't have such great karma.
Oh, God. You have lovely karma.
Hey,
actually,
it's not bad. If I get to talk about it with someone who met that person, I like being in that order in the game of telephone.
Yeah. But you know what, Sharon, particularly struck me in this conversation we had just 2 days ago was Duncan was being who he is and who he has been as a podcaster and just hanging out with us in, you know, at the retreats or whatever. And the level of self-honesty and willingness to share reminds me of somebody else we know. Ram Dass, and you do have that, and that willing. It's, you know, there's. I said it to you in a private text the other day. The courage to do that is very graceful. I mean, really,
is it courage? Sometimes I wonder if it's exhibitionism. Maybe there's not a difference.
You manage always to put that kind of twist in it. Yeah. We should
actually,
tell
Duncan,
this.
I really feel like I've learned a lot from you listening to you when I be with you at those retreats. So I really agree with what Raghu is saying.
Thank you. Mm. Well, I guess we're just all mirroring it back at each other. And you know, Sharon, it's almost a mantra in my life now. It's something that you taught me, which is the healing is in the return.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many times a week I remind myself of that. And I think that is such a beautiful summation of it all. And not just subjectively, you know, you remind yourself like the when I was emotionally unloading on Raghu about what I consider to be a kind of, you know, falling off the path, you know, he was giving me that reminder. You know, you could always go back. Like, that's the beauty of it. But I think, not to get too extraordinary here, but I think globally that that is an incredible thing for the planet to remind itself of, is that regardless of how absolutely insane things may seem subjectively or in a community, there's always that possibility to return to the Dharma, to the path, to just basic sanity. And there's no shame in it. I think sometimes a lot of people commit to their confusion. You know, they become so frustrated and so overwrought by their inability to maintain any kind of stability in a spiritual practice and a peaceful family and a peaceful community, that rather than keep trying again, they just commit to confusion. They commit to a kind of nihilism, I guess you could call it, but it mm-hmm. often masks itself as some kind of sophisticated attitude that,
yeah,
you know, but it's very just much. Nihilism. Yeah. And so I love that message that you send out. And to me, that is a touchstone of my practice.
Sharon, really, and the reality behind what you and Jack and Joseph brought back, I mean, not just you guys, but still, formidably, you brought back this practice that allows you immediately to connect with the breath. And that's such a powerful thing, you know, and it makes it much easier to return after you get lost, right?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I think that's the most important teaching I had, you know, that I received, was the healing is in the return. And you don't have to punish yourself for having wandered, gotten lost, gotten confused, gotten overwhelmed to begin with. And so that also brings me to a question, you know, which I think is reflected in your book, because I was just being interviewed by somebody earlier today, and we were trying to make a distinction between self-preoccupation and narcissism and self-love, because they're really very different. And for many of us, that sort of self-preoccupation is a form of, we're depleted, you know, we feel nihilistic, we feel empty inside, and so we're reaching out for anything to try to make us feel better, which is very different than self-love or self-compassion. So I wonder if one of you, either of you, or maybe both of you could speak to that.
Well, I guess, you know, we did this audiobook just for that reason, that preoccupation, which is just being lost in defending ourselves all the time, in reacting all the time. And then, so Duncan and I would talk about this, and then we'd say, you know, what happened to you when you were a tyke? You know, how did these formations occur of habitual patterns, neurotic tendencies, preoccupation with oneself? And it's crazy the way it's all built in, isn't it? I mean, you're a baby and you're cool and for about 6 months until you realize somebody gave you a name that said, this is who you are, except for your son there, that Duncan has this kid. How old is he now? Five?
He doesn't have a name?
Forrest.
No, that picture I sent you, that was Dune.
That was Dune.
Yeah.
Oh my God, they look exactly the same.
I know.
Anyhow, it was just this completely transparent, you know how these kids, they're completely transparent. I mean, it is so wonderful. But from the moment that you get the name, and then, you know, that's separation. It's built into the game. And then that's what we are looking at for the rest of our lives, is to, how do we reintegrate into reality?
Yeah.
Or, as
you know, Dune, he said something, you know, kids are always saying these profound things. And, you know, sometimes you're looking at your kid and you're just in love with them. Like, you are, sometimes me and Aaron joke that, yeah, we didn't get to meet Neem Karoli Baba, but we have a modular guru in the form of our three kids.
Yeah.
And sometimes, I mean, I think it's maybe as close as I could get to being around someone like that, because sometimes when I'm sitting with the kids with Dune, I'm just, you know, you're just so in love with him. Mm. And I'm looking at him. I don't know what my face must look like, but he looked at me and he said, "Are you in my heart now?" And I said, "Yes, I am, Dune. This, oh. I love you so much." And so I think that that's easy somehow to have a child and look at them in that way, but somehow turning that gaze back onto oneself and experiencing that same, "I just love you. I don't, it doesn't matter. I, whatever, it's fine." That for a lot of us is very difficult. And I think maybe the reason that's difficult is because the method we employ to do that has all this aggression in it, because that's what we've learned in our interaction with the world. So we aggressively try to love ourselves. We aggressively try to get into our heart. We aggressively try to, you know, achieve that state that I see in you, I see in Raghu. And in that aggression, there is a lot of compassion, in the sense that you know that you should love yourself so much that you would want to fight for it. You would want to fight, and you would want it to be fast. That's the other thing. And you want to control it. Mm-hmm. That's it. When I, you know, in my meditation practice, that's what I've really started noticing. It's like, you don't get to control this. It's a process. You just have to sit and watch the breath and be and do this regularly. And then it happens on its own. That, you know, it's the opposite of everything I have been taught as far as achievement, making things happen in the world. And I think that's quite alien to some of us.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Isn't it crazy, though, what we have to go through? And and one thing Duncan and I talked about the other day was he started off by, you know, talking about feeling like it stepped off the path for a minute, whatever, relating to practice. And, you know, and I said, well, you know, it's normal. We're all human. We love Jack Kornfield. Wonderful tone of voice. It's okay. We're all human. We're just human, you know. So we were saying that, and then, but the reality, it occurred to me in that moment, was there's not sequential. You get better and better and better at meditation or mindfulness or whatever it is, whatever practice it is. There are moments when you know, in this case, you need to fall off the wagon, so to speak, for a minute, and get to the place where you're not guilt tripping yourself about it the way you would do in any other part of your life. And it's beautiful, because without that, you can't unpeel more of the onion, so to speak, right? You got to have suffering. There has to be some suffering there, you know, that's part of us being human that allows us to be able to open further. And it's a process, and it goes back and forth. It's not like, you know, there's a sequential thing and you get to first base, then you get to second, then you get to third. It doesn't happen like that.
So in the book, Raghu, you talk about growing up, speaking about conditioning, growing up with a volatile father whom I'd met and a mother who was suffering from mental illness, and how much that has shaped you as an adult. And eventually you would go on to connect with Ram Dass and go over to India and met named Karoli Baba, also known as Maharaji. And amazingly, your whole family would eventually visit India and spend time with him. And here's a quotation from the book. "Our entire family was healed directly by what Maharaji did, particularly the sickest part of my family, my father's PTSD, and my mother's depression as well. She was much better after visiting India."
That's an understatement. Yeah. I could talk to him. Let's start there. We could have conversations that didn't end up in a, you know, raging, screaming match. Mm. I'm being a little bit dramatic, because you know what? Even when it was bad, I always knew he loved me. I didn't ever think that he did not love me. So that mitigated it to some degree. But what Maharaja, what Neem Karoli Baba did to get at his PTSD. It's funny because that's what they're doing now, you know, with MAPS, right, and all the experimentation around therapy with psilocybin and MDMA. Except in this case, it was acid. And he told me, okay, did you give your father the medicine? I'm like, yeah, he had a cold. I gave him some acid. Nay, the yogi medicine that Ram Dass, I went, what? Acid? It was the last thing in the whole world that I could imagine being in the same space with my father on acid, you know? Yeah. And he said, take care of your father while he's in India and meet me back in Allahabad in a couple of weeks. And we went to Benares where people go to die. Isn't that, it occurs to me too. Right. Wow, that's where he went to die. Right on the banks of that river where these bodies are being burned for thousands of years. And we went right by them, and people were, you know, dead body. There was a dead animal. There was a dead body that people were putting money on because it was a person who didn't have family. And if you don't get enough wood, buy enough wood, your body doesn't completely burn. And so this is what he encountered, my father, all the way, one step after another on this acid trip.
Can I ask, I wish I'd asked this in the book, whose choice was it to go to Varanasi to take acid? Was that your dad's choice or your choice, Raghu?
Well, we weren't going to Varanasi to take acid. I'll tell you that. No, we had planned.
Because India is a big place. All I'm saying is India is a very big place. There's lots of places to go. It is amazing that the place you chose to give your father his first LSD trip is potentially the most intense place
in the planet,
on planet Earth.
I don't know. I mean, I never expected to be told to give my father a hit of acid anywhere. And so we may have already had it planned. Oh, we'll show him Benares. It's a really interesting place.
That's the rascal in you, Raghu. I see the glitter in your eyes. Yeah, I know exactly what. That is really amazing that you did that. And you're right. I mean, symbolically, what an incredible place to be reborn.
To die. Yeah, to be reborn. Yeah, no, absolutely. Anyhow, so the result of that extraordinary time and experience was that I really then, our family just glued together. I mean, people, my father had a farm in Quebec and people used to come there, Ram Dass, all the satsang. You probably maybe showed up too. I can't remember.
Mm-hmm. I did.
Yeah. And we would have this satsang over a number of summers that were following the death of Neem Karoli Baba. Mm. We're held there, and you know, we used to go hang out with Trungpa Rinpoche, who was only a couple hours away in Vermont. Guys, Tale of the Tiger, great. Called something else now. So, yeah, very fortunate that this all took place and that healing took place.
Yeah,
I mean, so and people read that story, and you know, there's a great book called "Love Everyone" that Parvati Marcus did, and Mother of My Children, and it has all of our stories like that. And how we encountered through Ram Dass mostly Neem Karoli Baba and the stories of being in India. And when I look back at that you can't even say good fortune. That's beyond any kind of mental thing. And our relationship with Sharon and Joseph and Jack is a very important part of this. We all went to do Vipassana courses in India while we were. And when I say all, I actually mean maybe 80 to 90% of the people who saw Neem Karoli Baba at that time. And that's where I met Sharon. The rest is history.
Yeah. It's all history. And Duncan, you talk about your younger life. You moved around a lot and you experienced a lot of instability from your father, who also struggled with mental illness and alcoholism.
PTSD.
You were raised by your mom. And you had some usually impactful experiences with psychedelics starting in high school. And can you share how that led you to Ram Dass?
Yes. You know, I think, you know, most people go to liberal arts school. Like, you've got, what do you have in your dorm room? You've got Nag Champa, you've got patchouli, and you've got a copy of Be Here Now, inevitably.
Everyone has one, almost like they hand them out when you get into the school. And, you know, that was my first, the first time I saw Neem Karoli Baba was in Be Here Now. And I remember not knowing anything about him or the story, anything. And I looked at him and the first thing I thought is that my uncle? It was the weirdest thought. Like, it was just, you know, my brain popped that out. And then I'm like, I guess he kind of looks like my Uncle Jimmy, maybe. Jim. And then, you know, the comedian path is just chaos and uncertainty. And statistically, you're going to fail. Like, it's an incredibly difficult industry to break into at all, and especially in LA. And so, I started somehow, I don't know, I found them on the internet, all these old bootleg tapes of Ram Dass speaking. And I was so depressed. I was just depressed and just wanting to give up and in a apartment filled with roaches, you know, climb on you. Like it was just dead broke. I mean, I'm making it sound like maybe a little more Dickinsonian than it was. It was also very fun. But I don't know. I guess I went to the Love Serve Remember website and I saw this thing. You could do heart to hearts with Ram Dass. No mention of like payment, which I certainly wouldn't have been able to do back then. And I thought, there's no way this is going to work. And then I signed up for one. And so there I am in my like just dilapidated bachelor pad. And suddenly Ram Dass is on the screen of my computer. I couldn't believe it. It was, you know, it's like sunlight blasting into your life out of nowhere. And I remember the first question I asked him, because we all would love this, is I'm like, are you my guru? And he goes, yes, now what? It was the funniest, perfect response. You know, he read, you know, because the idea would be you meet your guru and then it's better. Everything immediately better. Nothing to do after that.
Well, wait, the interesting thing is he never said that to anyone I ever met when they asked him, I am not a guru, okay?
Yeah.
I'll lend you mine, but I'm not one. So you're the only disciple of Ram Dass.
I don't know if he was, I think he was trying to convey to me in a beautiful way that there was some externalism or spiritual materialism in that question. Mm. You know, now I have a guru. Everything's fine. You know, whereas it's like, you're still in the same place. Like, I'm your guru. You're still in that apartment. You're still in the consciousness that you have. You're still exactly where you're at. Now what? And so that was the first time I met him. And, you know, I won't go into all the details, but, you know, I reached out to the foundation because I wanted to do some kind of sedna service.
Seva,
thank you. And so, you know, all I had to offer was like, well, I do a podcast. I could teach you guys to do podcasts. And then I remember Raghu came over to my house to do my podcast. And oh boy, was I prepared for disappointment. Just because, you know, spiritual community, Ram Dass beer. Now I was like expecting a dude in robes or with embarrassing necklaces or, you know, glittery rings or just all kinds of, my mind had already prepared myself for the disappointment. Oh yeah, this is there's no way that, you know, whatever happened in India didn't sustain itself in any kind of living way. It's going to be a scam. And then there's Raghu, completely normal, just perfect, you know, with your beautiful cynicism and your sense of humor. And so then we have this amazing podcast and you leave. And then I'm looking in the mirror and I remember thinking, God, I got too stoned for that podcast. I hope he doesn't think I'm like a weirdo because I'm so high. And then I realized I didn't smoke weed. And that was my first experience of what you all have taught me of Bhav. That thing that happens when you get around the satsang, that thing, it's a natural psychedelic feeling, a kind of joyful high or something. Mm. And then, you know, then we became friends, thank God. And then you taught me a lot and we did this book together. Lots of other stories that would take 4,000 hours to talk about.
Sharon, when you talk about, there's some similarities, like we haven't really thought about it. Duncan and I never really talked about the similarities. Obviously, there's a couple of decades between us age-wise, but yeah, there is a lot of similarities in terms of the kind of parental unit that we had and the societal relationship and so on, which is probably why it, you know, the, by the way, it's, the audio book is really what you want. The ebook, yeah, you can read it, but without the banter back and forth, you miss a lot of the fun. But now I kind of realize, yeah, we have a lot in common, socially in common, aside from art.
Well, it's really true, and me too, of course. And so, you know, there's something about the willingness to really step away from the expectations of society and self-expectation and in a way to be unconventional that is usually born out of some kind of suffering, you know, and insistence on going deeper, which I find really fascinating. And it's one of those, you know, of course, we don't want to have had those experiences, but look at what happened in the end,
right?
You know, because of that. While we're talking about Ram Dass, he's a part of your book in a lot of different ways. And one way is that chapter in the book where he's telling his everybody's Uncle Henry story related to the price he chose for the Love Serve Remember vinyl box set he put together. And would one of you share that story?
Yeah, it's kind of core Ram Dass. I mean, the Ram Dass was just so generous, really. And I mean, in the days that we were actually together with Neem Karoli Baba, at one point, Maharaji, that's what we called him, he said to Ram Dass, you know, yeah, saints don't carry money around. They don't deal with money, you know? So you shouldn't be dealing with money. I am sure it was meant in terms of attachment.
Yeah.
Not so much the thing, which is the reality for all of what we are relating with in an attached or grasping way. But Ram Dass decided he was going to take this instruction literally, and he went and he got my brother, who is the last person in the world that can deal with money. I mean, thank God he was married to this wonderful woman, that's our friend, who had an ability in that way. And so it all worked out. But it didn't work out for Ram Dass at all. Oh, my God. Yeah, so... Yeah, you know, Ram Dass, in the book, you know, to me, the greatest thing that, you know, the first part of the book is us talking about the ways in which we're dealing with, you know, attachment and habitual patterns and neurotic tendencies and our life experience and sharing that. And hopefully people can relate with that. But then the latter part of the book is about, okay, what do you do about this shit, you know? And so there's a closer, which is we picked one particular excerpt from a talk of Ram Dass. And what was it about? It was all about compassion and generosity. And Sharon, I don't know if you remember, but we went and into that very subject deeply at a retreat in Maui, 2014-15, something like that, at that beautiful place, Lumeria. You remember that place?
I do remember. Yeah.
And we went into it then, and it is absolutely the recipe for being able to transform out of that preoccupied, as we talked about in the beginning, preoccupied self
Yeah.
And that's what Duncan and I have been doing. Almost all of our podcasts really have that as a central theme, because we want to, you know, I guess we have a penchant to share with people what it is that we are going through. And hopefully, just like Ram Dass did, that generosity of sharing. When I first lecture I heard of his, and just his ability to talk about his how fallible he was, and not be scared to talk about it, which is what we mentioned before, which Duncan does now, that just gave so much relief. Oh my God, I was relieved. Okay, I'm not this gigantic ass that absolutely has no way of knowing how to navigate anything except from that me point of view. And yeah, that's a big thing, very big.
Well, it reminds me in a way of the first time I really heard more about the Buddhist teaching, which was in college in this Asian philosophy course, and just the Buddha talking about suffering. While a lot of people consider that quite depressing, for me, it was like this amazing message. It was like, oh, this is a part of life. It's not just me. It's not just my weird family. It's not, you know, just my terrible circumstance. It's like, oh, I belong. You know, that we all belong, that we're all included in the joys and the sorrows and just like this bigger picture of life. And that's what got me to India, was finally feeling I'm not so weird, you know? This is a part of life.
And, you know, I guess, Duncan, you speaking to the fact that I met Neem Karoli Baba, Sharon met Deepa Ma, another very extraordinary being. And you didn't. And we've been dealing with that, you know, at these retreats a lot. I think you've gone beyond it, actually, at this point. I don't think you really think about it much anymore.
I don't.
But, yeah. But I, you know, the reality of what that thing is that's in that being is completely shareable.
Yeah.
You know, on so many different planes that we inhabit.
Yeah.
It is shareable, and it is not exclusive to a body. And we were told that exact thing from Neem Karoli Baba.
Well, this is
not about physical body.
This makes me think of another. This is what I've become. I just talk about my kids now. But another profound moment I had with the kids, with Forrest. And this is when I, you know, you never really stop grieving when you lose a mom. But this is when I was, you know, still going through it more than I am now. And I was fixing breakfast for him, and very early in the morning. And, you know, when you're fixing breakfast for your kids, and you aren't like, oh, I'm so tired, or oh my God, I have all this to do today. You really like are being generous in the sense that you're just not thinking about yourself. You're just, you can't wait to see your kids eat pancakes. There's something incredible about watching a toddler eat pancakes. Like you're seeing like just such pure joy and passion, and just, and there's no expectation when you're giving your kid food. They're not thinking that like, there's any agenda that you're, it's a business meeting, you're picking up the tab. They expect it. You're their parent. And so, and I'm feeling all this love. I'm playing Enya because my mom used to love Enya. Now I can't play it around the kids. They won't let me, but he was too young to know that you could control the Alexa. And so like Enya's playing, and I'm feeling this pure love. And then it occurred to me, oh, you know what? I bet my mom felt like this when she was cooking for me and my brother. And right when I thought that, Forrest stops eating, looks at me and goes, did you find me? And it was so, the timing was so perfect. And that was a real epiphanous moment for me, because I realized, oh yeah, just what you're saying. The form of the mother, the physical form of the mother is one tiny part. It's like a flower growing from that love you feel when you're cooking for your kids, when you're being purely generous. That in that moment, you meet your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, you meet everybody minus all of the obscurations or cliches. You meet like the purest form of the thing that is behind anything any enlightened being said, I would guess. And so, yeah, I know that now. Like, you don't need the embodied guru, the embodied mother. I do often think of Annie Lamont's story, though. The little kid. They were talking about, you know, Jesus. You can contact Jesus in prayer. And the kid says, I want Jesus with skin on. And sometimes we do, you know, it would be nice to have that with skin on. But, you know, I think this, everything that we're talking about here is you begin to realize, like, the skin is on. It's on you. It's everything around you. It's, you know, it's wearing many, many masks, but underneath it is that, whatever that is. And it's an ocean. It's, and what do they call it? An immeasurable. It's unquantifiable.
Yeah. That's the beauty of Buddhist version of reality, shall we say, is this is inside here. Test it out, Buddha said.
Yeah.
It's tested out, you know. And that's why, you know, Sharon, I love the fact that we got pushed, I don't know how, into meeting you in India and doing Vipassana meditation and carrying it back. And it's been, I think for most of us, a through line in terms of our practice. And the fact that that blend with our, where we came from, which was bhakti yoga, the yoga of love, that blend, which really prominently features discriminating wisdom, is extraordinarily helpful, I think. It has been for us, and I think it is for whoever we share with.
I think everyone's path is in a way uniquely our own, you know? And it's going to have these different elements in it and at different times also. And we are very lucky, all of us, whether, you know, you were physically in the presence of these great beings or not. And we're very lucky they have existed, and their impact is not confined to their body. And the same thing with one's mom or, you know, the particular relationship. The impact is not confined to the physical presence of a person. It is so much deeper than that. And it does reflect what in the Buddhist tradition I did always find breathtaking, which was this view of human nature, which is like, we actually can really do it, you know, like we can grow, we can change, we can understand, we can love. And that potential is never destroyed. It may be covered over, it often is. It may be hidden from view, it may be hard to trust, but it is absolutely there. And in a way, I think that's what Ram Dass was always saying when he would say, look at the soul of the person you're talking to. And he did that not in a gooey way. You know, when I look back at my conversations with Ram Dass, one of the things I actually remember is he was a really good therapist, you know? He was smart and distinct. It wasn't like there was a universal message, you know, but there was also very personal messages that were coming through. Like, yeah, I'm your guru, which is, now we know the only person in the universe who said that.
Duncan.
You know, I always wanted it, the name. I wanted something magical from him. And of course he knew that. But he would, I remember he just, you know, when I was really wrecked, cancer, grieving, just wrecked, but trying to not seem so wrecked. But at one point he said, you need therapy. And I totally overlooked that. I'm like, that's funny, Ram Dass. And then finally I got therapy. And it, you know, changed my life. He was totally right. He knew, like, yeah, I could give you a mantra, but you're out of your mind right now. Like, you need therapy. Go to therapy. And so that's what I loved about him. He was very pragmatic, too. There wasn't just all this, like, sky mind woo-woo-y stuff within him was a very, very, there was like a steely, and I don't mean that in a, you know, in a
Spartan sense,
wrathful in the Buddhist sense, you know, not wrathful and like, I'm going to hurt you, but wrathful. And this is a skillful means that he could execute in at the right time, just when you needed it. And I mean, all of these traits, people like him and you and Raghu exhibit, you know, they spark off of you. It's not like you're planning to be like that. It's just suddenly something comes out of your mouth and, you know, you have completely shifted someone's life. You know, that's what you guys have done. That's the other remarkable thing to me about you, Sharon and Raghu, is that you never gave up. You know what I mean? It seems like it would be quite normal at some point, mid-80s, to just be like, I was on a lot of acid, and I don't know, that was my crazy phase when I met my guru or whatever. I'm going to get into banking. But you guys kept that to me, that tirelessness, you know, that... isn't that one of the paramitas, Sharon? Like, what is that?
Yeah, it's like resolution or...
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, you both exemplify this in a way that you... It's not like you're proud. And in fact, I've never heard either of you say anything about that facet of it, but it really is remarkable to consider decades and decades and decades of having to be patient with us. We're annoying. the ayahuasca stories. Oh my God, I can't imagine how many ayahuasca stories you've had to endure, among other things. And the patience, you know, that to me, that's one of the characteristics of Ram Dass and the teachers that I think is really inspiring. You know,
Sharon, I know this is your podcast, and but I want to ask a question.
Yeah.
So we were just talking about whatever this thing is in people beings that you and I have met who have inspired us, and that's an insubstantial word for what really happened. But the reality is that whatever is shared in the moment is shareable without a body. We know that.
Mm-hmm. You
know? We know that from so many different, in so many different ways. So, you know, and Duncan and I, in this audiobook, Movie of Me to the Movie of We, talk about different ways in which we can reinforce, maybe not the greatest word to talk about, how to bring in that same unconditionality is the best word I can use, to bring that into our daily lives by virtue of the kind of practice that, and it's okay to fall off that practice, so we all agree on that up front. We're going to sign the agreement. Yep, okay. It's okay to fall off. But what would be your biggest advisal in terms of a practice that allows that unconditionality into our hearts?
I think in some ways the practice will look different for different people and different at different times in our lives. But I think the essence of all those practices is the ability to be with our experience in a way with, to quote Ram Dass, with loving awareness rather than the particular train of judgment we tend to jump on. And, you know, that's partly what's reinforced in these relationships with these gurus. I mean, certainly, you know, with a teacher, you would expect rejection or disdain or something as you reveal more of yourself, or they just seem to know more about you. And you think, really, you know, like, this has got to be the end, and it's never the end because they're on your side. You know, there's not like a hidden agenda, like about their own veneration or regard. It's all about your freedom. And we adopt that. We do the same thing in our meditation practice. It's like for once in our lives. You know, we find our minds wander and we don't endlessly judge ourselves or castigate ourselves about it. Or we have that sneaky emotion we've never allowed ourselves to feel. And rather than feel like we failed and, oh my God, I've been meditating for all these years, why is this still here? Or whatever it might be, we learn to regard all those experiences in a different way. And so I think a lot of these practices essentially end up being, you know, it's like they're doing a very similar thing, even though they may stylistically be quite different. But the hardest thing is actually doing a practice. You know, it's like, yeah, it's so easy to think about or recommend it to others, or, you know, write books about, you know, but it's not that easy to do. It takes a kind of humility and a willingness to experiment and courage and all of that.
Yeah, I guess, well, Ram Dass's loving awareness practice certainly is what, you know, is certainly recommended, because it's so simple. But loving kindness practice is is also not also. It is a core way in which to develop heartfulness.
Yeah.
And these practices. Well, I think it was Duncan who asked me what Raghu you so often quote of me, which was really delightful to be reacquainted with because I had no memory of having said it. Was, I think Duncan asked me why I meditated or what happened when I meditated. Is that right, Raghu?
What is your practice, Sharon? Uh-huh. And you said, I get up and sit and get real. Yeah. That's my favorite thing ever.
Yeah, it's mine too, and I didn't know I'd said it.
And what happened to you after she said that, Duncan?
Look, you don't want to know.
Did you get real?
I have an unstable practice. I mean, that's what I was whining to Raghu about, is I managed to meditate, you know, consistently longer than I ever have in my life, and was experiencing all of those things. I know you're not, it shouldn't be a transactional thing, you know, but it's still, no matter what, whether you like it or not, you notice a positive shift in your life, or none of us would be talking about it. And not just a positive shift, just sort of almost like a new life or something. You just start seeing like, wow, this is a way I can be that is helping everyone around me. Which is what I love about Buddhism's dedication of the merit and the idea that you're not doing this necessarily for yourself. I mean, I look at it as like, if I could do this, anyone can do it. Like, if I could which is maybe a grandiose thing to think anyway, but that's maybe why I felt so bummed out, because I started thinking, whoa, if I can get calm like this and organized like this and less neurotic and more present with my family, knowing me, then this is a bona fide path. Like, this does work. And now I'm like, oh, well, maybe it doesn't. Maybe it works temporarily, but I don't mean that. I do think it works, but yeah. So, but conversations like this remind me, they remind me of, you know, when you're meditating a lot and it's not like you become a split personality, but when you start gaining familiarity with awareness, and this awareness is initially very aware of the body, very aware of the emotional states, very aware of the thinking mind, very aware of the future, very aware of the past, it's fixating on that. And then you start realizing, oh, I don't have to, like, that awareness can expand beyond me ruminating over bombing on stage or a book deadline or failing at this or that, that I can actually just put the awareness on the breath, and it goes there. And then, well, if I can put the awareness on the breath, I could shift it into my heart. And so suddenly it's like, you just realize you're in a much bigger house than you thought you were, you know? And then a spontaneous sort of compassion for the part of you that wasn't aware of that happens naturally. So it's not like you're like, oh, look at you, you dilapidated house of a man. It's more like we did it. You know, you found this too. Like this is just reminding me that like when I am kind of like a little confused, it's good to remember that confusion is taking place within that awareness, or it wouldn't mm-hmm. exist at all. You know, the mm-hmm. two things are completely interdependent, you know, and if you don't get confusion without awareness, you know, and but confusion is a lot louder, isn't it? It's just so much louder. It's like a barking dog in your neighbor's yard, except it's in your head.
Yeah. Well, actually, I want to offer you both one more Ram Dass quotation from your book, where he says, you need to remember Buddha nature and your social security number.
Yeah, that's right.
So however confused we get, and we do, for sure. I think the gap we're looking for, in a way, is between what we're feeling and how we're acting. You know, so that we can acknowledge our confusion. We can love ourselves anyway, maybe. We can hang out with it and not, like, forget to pay our taxes.
Yes. Yes.
Good timing on that thought.
Yes, I thought it was a good
timing.
We
are in the middle of April.
What do you mean? Oh, you're supposed to pay taxes? I thought you only had to pay taxes once. Wait, what? Hold on, I gotta go.
Yeah.
Wait,
so
what?
Sorry. So sorry.
No, I love that. That is, to me, the best. And, you know, as a comedian, and I think a lot of us acid heads, we go pure sky mind. Pure, you know, the earth has been so brutal. The earth can be quite brutal, or you start associating your childhood with the earth or with the... you know, day-to-day reality, you see this as a trap. It's the Matrix, man. I'm not going to invest any time in that. I want to be free. And then you get this incredible imbalance where you become lost in the clouds and you look down at social security numbers and names. Whoa, this isn't my real name. I'm a nameless thing. And this is why I love having a family. I mean, this is why it was the greatest gift, is because it anchors you to the earth. And that balance is so beautiful. And the earth isn't bad, and the social security number isn't bad. Mm-hmm. Taxes, they suck, but you know what I mean? Within it all is the same thing that we're talking about. You know, that's the thing. I'll leave a Ram Dass quote. When you fall from the path, that's the path too. Mm-hmm. And you know, this bifurcation between the sacred and the profane that we all do, it ignores the fact the entirety of the human experience is mystical and rare.
This is what we talked about a couple of days ago. There's no worldly life, and then there's a spiritual life.
Right.
There's only one thing going on. And from that purview, we can navigate in a way that's just, as Trungpa Rinpoche said to Ram Dass, take responsibility. One time at Tale of the Tiger, and it's on video. We actually have a video of it. Yeah, take responsibility. Or Ram Dass was told by his spook friend, Ram Dass, take the curriculum.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what we're doing. And it's okay. It's all okay.
Yeah, but you do got to get back to class. You can't just sit in the bleachers smoking dope. I mean, that's the problem. You got to get back in there.
Oh, God. No,
that's a great note to end on. Take the curriculum. Here we are.
Take the curriculum, yeah.
So thank you so much for creating the book, the audio book. And thank you so much for hanging out today. And
oh, let me give a plug, though. Movieofme.com. That's where to go. And you'll have excerpts there, everything about the book, and all the links to the different places you can get it.
And let me just say, Sharon, thank you so much for your work. And thank you for all of your books that I have around the house. And I just know whenever I need it's like a tuning fork. When I'm way out of tune, I just have to pick up one of your books and start reading. And I get back in tune. And I think I speak for probably millions of people who have those tuning forks around their house in one way or the other. And so thank you so much for sharing your wisdom
and
your teaching with us.
I like that. Sharon's tuning fork. This could produce something else, Sharon.
Merch.
Yeah, baby. Don't forget like your agent. Credit card Merch, number. Roger. Merch, baby. Sharon's tuning fork.
Yeah. Oh, and should we mention that we're going to end? We're going to end with Ram Dass?
Yes. So we're going to end our gathering, our coming together with a practice from Ram Dass that's included in the book, and that's the practice of loving awareness.
Great. Thank you so much, Sharon.
Thank you.
Maharaji has affected me by loving me. And therefore, I love you. It's just a therefore. So this is a meditation you attend to a point in the heart space in the middle of the chest, and you will say, I am loving awareness. I am loving awareness. You were I am ego. And you're going to become the reality of your the true self, the capital S. So you're going to start thinking about, I think this is crap. I don't know. I can do without this, or that's the ego. Because see, what I did when Maharaji said, "I want you to love everybody," I said, "I can't do it," which that meant I. My ego can't do it. And he just ignored it because he wanted to dance with my soul. Dance with my soul. The soul, we're going to make loving awareness. So think of yourself. Think of your I. Start with this and go down to this. Start with I am loving awareness. I am loving awareness. Remember to point at the middle of the chest. I am loving awareness. I am loving awareness. in the future, you will know yourself as loving awareness. It's, if you, somebody asks you, say, you're Jack, you don't say, I am loving awareness. Because but you yourself will say, when you walk down the street, when you go into the marketplace, I am loving awareness. I am loving awareness. I am loving awareness. Now take on that identity instead of the identity you had before. You shift your identity. I am loving awareness. I am loving awareness. The awareness is yourself. It's not a thing. It is no thing. It's no objective thing. You can't point to awareness. You're aware of your eyes seeing. You're aware of your ears hearing. You're aware of your thoughts as they come out of your mind. So, like, this'll never work. That's a thought. And just label it as a thought. Label thoughts. Label thoughts. This loving awareness is the witness of your incarnation.
Hey folks, thanks so much for listening. If you'd like to learn more about Duncan and Raghu's new audiobook that is also available in ebook formats, you can head over to the website movieofme.com. That's MOVIEOFME.com. And for all things Sharon, including online courses, her upcoming virtual events, or a free guided meditation, you can check out SharonSalzberg.com. This has been the Meta Hour podcast, brought to you by the Be Here Now Network. May you be safe, may you be happy, may you be healthy, and may you live with ease.